How do we find real masculinity with Jesus hanging on a cross? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April is titled Man Up, The Quest for Masculinity. It's written by regular guest Pastor Jeff Hemmer. You can find out more at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Men in all stages of life will appreciate Man Up. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Man Up, 1-800-325-3040. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's a thorny issue, if you stop and think about it. You go into the Old Testament, and almost from the very beginning of the Old Testament, you have husbands with more than one wife. In some cases, one or two more. In some cases, well, like Solomon, hundreds more than one wife. What do Christians do with Old Testament polygamy? What does Jesus have to say, if anything, about the practice? And how do we respond to those who say, well, since Jesus seems silent and the Old Testament seems to be silent on it being something that's bad, Abraham was polygamous and most of his descendants were as well. Why are you Christians worried about that? It's just another form of marital love. Joining us to talk about polygamy, Pastor David Kind. He's pastor of University Lutheran Chapel in Minneapolis and author of a chapter in the book Ethics of Sex titled Polygamy and Its Contemporary Variations in Biblical Perspective. Pastor Kind, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. Glad to be with you today.
Polygamy isn't just an academic question for biblical scholars anymore, is it? Why is that?
Yeah, polygamy has sort of made a crash into the popular culture again through a lot of TV shows regarding it, as well as the whole argument over what marriage is that we've been going through these past several years. The fact that you find polygamy in the Bible, as well as in several other religions like Islam and Mormonism, has been used by those trying to push the boundaries of marriage to show that marriage isn't always between one man and one wife, and that these variant types of marriages are perfectly acceptable so long as they are loving and consensual and such. So polygamy, which, you know, used to be sort of a taboo that we talked about, you know, weird people do this, you know, sort of the Mormons out in the back country, that kind of thing, has suddenly become a viable alternative, people think, to a monogamous marriage between a man and a wife.
Let's define terms a little bit, because while in kind of the biblical study of this, it is predominantly polygamy, that is one man with multiple wives. Today we're talking about, in contemporary American culture and elsewhere, polyamory and things like that. How would you define the terms?
Yeah, when I talk about polygamy, I'm basically talking about one man and many wives, but the rules that apply in terms of marriage and in terms of sexual relationships apply across the board, that any form of having multiple partners would fall under the biblical standard of polygamy.
So let's talk about kind of the approach to the Old Testament and New Testament that we need to keep in mind when dealing with the issue of polygamy. I mean, the technical terms here would be your hermeneutical approach, but how would you describe how we approach the biblical narrative and teaching on this?
You know, Todd, I think the most important thing that people often miss is that just because the Bible talks about something, even in relating a historical event or such, does not mean that God has put his stamp of approval on it. So when we read the scriptures and we find polygamous relationships amongst the patriarchs, for example, nowhere do we find God saying, I command this, or even I allow this, or recommend it, or bless it, or anything like that. But neither do we find anywhere where God explicitly condemns it or says this is a bad thing. So we're looking at historic narratives, and we have to recognize that many times in those historical narratives, things are done and related to us as having been done that do not have a clear word from God on whether they are good or bad. So what we need to do is apply what we know from the rest of scriptures to that question of whether this is acceptable or not.
Okay, so we're talking about a case here where while God is silent on polygamy per se, is it safe to say, Pastor Kind, that he's hardly silent on marriage?
That's exactly right. And when we look at polygamy, the first place that we look to determine whether or not this is a God-pleasing practice is what has God instituted? What does marriage look like according to God's plan? And what does human sexuality look like?
What are the origins of polygamy in the Old Testament as far as we can discern?
Well, it's interesting, Todd. The very first time that we see polygamy mentioned is in the pre-flood world, in the line of Cain. Now, if you remember the story of Cain and Abel, I know you do, and I hope the listeners do as well. Cain is the one who murdered his brother, was exiled from the Edenic family, and by his own words, exiled from God. That was his determination of it. So the line of Cain in the Old Testament basically portrays the succession of unbelief from father to child over a series of generations. In this line, you find a great emphasis on human achievement, because, of course, without the divine as the center for worship, man himself becomes God in his own eyes. So our own accomplishments become the things that we're known for. Now, at the end of that line is one nuclear family that sort of culminates the unbelief of Cain's line, and that is the family of Lamech. And Lamech is the first person mentioned in the Bible who has more than one wife. And it doesn't say it's bad or good. It simply says, and Lamech had two wives, and that gives their names. But Lamech also had sons, one of whom happened to be a blacksmith, very skilled in the arts of blacksmith, such that he's called the father of all of those who do this work. Now, Lamech brags in this brief section of his biography about how he has killed a man and that if anybody tries to take vengeance on him, Lamech will take vengeance 70-fold against them, an amplification of what God had said regarding should anyone try to kill Cain. Of course, God didn't say anything to Lamech. Lamech takes this upon himself, and many scholars believe that Lamech actually hadn't killed anybody yet, but he'd gotten a weapon from his son, the blacksmith, and admiring this weapon, declares this thing, look at my power, look at my strength. If anybody tries to touch me, I'll wipe them out. I'll take 70-fold vengeance upon them. Now, this is sort of portrayed in the Genesis account as the culmination of the line of unbelief. And then right there in the middle of it, you have Lamech had two wives. And the wives' names indicate that one was beautiful. So you have the injection of potentially lust in there, that he took the second wife for the beauty, what have you. But it's not in the line of Seth, the line of faith, that you find polygamy. It's in the line of Lamech. And then immediately after this section on Lamech, we don't hear any more about Cain's line anymore. Presumably there were more descendants, but Lamech and his sons are sort of the pinnacle of that line of unbelief.
So I think you even mentioned in your chapter in the book that Luther kind of weighs in on this in a general sense, talking about two different churches. What does Luther say?
Well, Luther says that the one church is the church, obviously, of Christ, which is the line of Seth, that this is the faithful. But the other is basically the church of men, that this church always wars against the church of Christ. And it attempts to undo the work of God.
So the original recounting in the Old Testament of a polygamous relationship is set in the context of someone who is, to kind of put it in basic terms, living in open rebellion against God.
Absolutely. And this is the reason I believe that it's mentioned at all, is that this is part and parcel of that open rebellion, is that this man has rejected what God gives, and is taking life into his own hands and determining for himself what is good and what is bad, and that through power, basically.
So we find then polygamy eventually being practiced even among the patriarchs, even among the faithful. Talk about that.
Yeah, and that's the troubling thing for believers, is that we find the patriarchs, the people who stand at the head of the Old Testament church, at least in the post-flood world, practicing polygamy. Now, it starts with Abraham, really, though he's never said to have more than one wife. Abraham, of course, is the one who took his wife's servant to bed in order to get an heir, from which comes Ishmael, the father of, at least if we believe their accounts, the father of Islam and of the Arabs. Now, this was, of course, an attempt by Abraham and Sarah to fulfill the Lord's promise that Abraham would have an heir from his own flesh. Well, Sarah's ancient and has been barren her whole life. Abram's getting very old. And so they take matters into their own hands, and Sarah says, here, take my maid Hagar. And Abraham simply says, okay, and has a child with her. Now, he doesn't marry her, but in biblical terms, he has united himself to her, and there has been an offspring from that union that reflects that their one fleshness, if you will. But he's married already to Sarah. Well, this causes immense problems in Abram's family, so much so that in the end, Abraham says to Sarah, look, she's your maid. If you want to get rid of her, just get rid of her. I don't want to have to deal with this anymore, is basically the idea he's promulgating there. And she does. And Hagar is sent out into the wilderness. Ishmael grows up, of course, with the Lord's blessing out there because God is gracious. But it sets up a perpetual situation of conflict between the family of Isaac, the legitimate heirs of Abraham through Sarah, and the family of Ishmael, the illegitimate heirs through his polygamous union with Hagar.
So to summarize that, when we first meet Abraham, he's given a promise by God. In his attempt to see that promise through himself, in effect, he resorts to what is polygamous. He takes a concubine or a mistress, so to speak, as a wife. And that is the context there is then in Abraham's failure to believe God's promise. And you're also pointing out here, it has ongoing generational consequences for Abraham.
Oh, that's exactly right. You have conflict within Abraham's immediate family to begin with, so that there's no peace in the household. Hagar tries to elevate herself over Sarah. Sarah gets upset, kicks her out. And this is built in to polygamous relationships, this idea of conflict and a battle for supremacy. But there's also, as you said, these generational, in fact, millennia-long results from this that we're still facing today. And it all comes, as I said, because Abraham does try to take God's promises into his own hands and fulfill them by his own power, which, you know, is this strange admixture of faith and idolatry. But it's from that, the idolatry, that polygamy finds its way into the patriarchal family.
The polygamy skips a generation with Isaac, who has but one wife, but then Jacob kind of doubles down on the practice.
He does. Jacob's situation is also interesting. Jacob didn't enter into a polygamous relationship by choice initially. If, as you recall from the history, he is duped by his father-in-law into marrying the wrong sister, Leah, whom he did not love, and does not receive the wife that he had been waiting for and working for 7 years. Well, in answer to that, he doesn't simply say, well, I guess I have a wife. We'll live with it. He says, I'll work another 7 years if you give me the other one. And ends up with two wives, both of whom are sisters, which, by the way, is a practice that later on in Mosaic Code is strictly outlawed, that you shall not marry a wife or make a wife of two sisters simultaneously. As you can imagine, this causes immense conflict in the family, so much so that there ends up being this sort of baby-making contest between the two sisters. And when they go infertile, they continue the contest by proxy by giving Jacob their maids as concubines. So really, Jacob ends up with four wives, where all he desired was one in the first place. But much like Abraham, he just kind of goes along with it without asking the question, is this what God wants?
Pastor David Kind is our guest. We're talking about polygamy on this Monday afternoon. When we come back, more of the Old Testament patriarchs and polygamy. Stay tuned.
daily exercise for the Christian mind, you're listening to Issues Etc.
The Reformation's relevancy, natural law, news discernment, modern-day apostles and prophets, depression, catechizing our children. You can meet and hear Issues Etc. regular guests discussing these topics at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 9th and 10th in Collinsville, Illinois. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Registration is $120. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 9th and 10th in Collinsville, Illinois.
St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Wildwood, Missouri is a proud sponsor of Issues Etc. And if you enjoy the relevant, Christ-centered teachings presented on this program, then you should come and join us at St. Paul's on Sundays at 9 a.m., where you will hear sermons that proclaim Jesus Christ and Him crucified for our sins, and enjoy in-depth Bible studies to help us grow as disciples. For more information, check us out at stpaullutheranwildwood.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilk. We're talking about polygamy with Pastor David Kine, pastor of University Lutheran Chapel in Minneapolis, author of a chapter in the book Ethics of Sex titled Polygamy and Its Contemporary Variations in Biblical Perspective. You are a campus pastor, Pastor Kine. Take a few minutes, if you would, and tell us about LCMSU.
Todd, LCMSU is the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod's effort to strengthen and spread campus ministry on the campuses of our universities around the country. It's a relatively new effort, came into existence 4 or 5 years ago. For a long time, our synod had an official campus ministry wing to it, but it was lost during the budget cuts of about 15 years ago, and for a long time, the synod just wasn't doing anything in terms of campus ministry on a national level. So LCMSU is the new effort. And we have found it to be a huge blessing through the conferences that are put on for college students and through the encouragement that's provided for campus ministries and campus pastors around the country. It's really been a blessing to us.
Folks, you can find out more about LCMSU at lcms.org/LCMSU, lcms.org/LCMSU. So all along, if we're paying attention to the details, the polygamy of the patriarchs is being described to us, while not the focus of the narrative, it is certainly being described to us in far less than positive terms.
Yeah, you would be hard-pressed to find a single positive mention of polygamy in the Old Testament where there's, you know, blessings come from this directly. Mind you, God uses these things and blesses the people, of course. We get the 12 tribes of Israel, for instance, out of the four wives of Jacob. But you don't find anywhere where this is a happy, loving, successful type of practice that God encourages.
What do we find in the law itself, that is the Mosaic law in the Old Testament, that speaks to the issue, however indirectly, of polygamy? You already mentioned not taking sisters as wives.
Right. So first of all, nowhere is it endorsed in the Mosaic Code, and I think that's extremely important to point out. But the Mosaic Code does attempt to regulate some polygamous situations. This is more along the lines of attempting to mitigate the negative outcomes of polygamy within the family unit. Much of the Mosaic Code, especially if you read through Leviticus, for instance, or Deuteronomy, is focused on maintaining the family unit as a, first of all, strong basis upon which Israelite society is built, but also in holiness in relation to the presence of God among them. So holiness and strength are two of the emphases. Now, polygamy is never portrayed positively, as I said. It's never said that this is holy or that this helps make a strong family or even that this helps increase the number of Israelite soldiers, for instance, or something, that you could have more children and more workers and fighters and what have you. We do find a few regulations, much like we do about divorce, that attempt to sort of mitigate the problems that polygamy causes. Now, when we look at the New Testament, of course, we know what Jesus says about the Mosaic Code regarding divorce, Jews come to him and say, can we just divorce our wives for any reason? And Jesus, first of all, says that Moses allowed these things because of the hardness of your hearts. In other words, this was a sin that was going on in Israel, and through Moses, this thing gets regulated a little bit to mitigate the problems that are being caused by it. Again, with a view to the holiness of the community and with a view to the strength of the family. But then he points us back to Genesis chapters 1 and 2, and the fact that Adam is given one wife who is one flesh with him. So the Lord says, in the beginning it is not so. And I would argue that the same thing applies to the regulations regarding polygamy. In the beginning it was not so, but these things are given basically to help mitigate the mess that the Israelites are making with their multiple wives.
The thorniest question of all here before we leave behind the Mosaic Law probably is, why, if it's negatively portrayed in the narrative, if it is mitigated and regulated in terms of the Mosaic Law, and as you said, Jesus tells us the way these laws ought to be read is one husband, one wife, why doesn't God simply explicitly forbid polygamy? Is there an answer to that question?
No, that's a very hard question, and we have to be careful not to read our thoughts into the biblical text on that to try to come up with an answer. Like I said, it's very much like divorce, where in the Mosaic Code, divorce is not forbidden expressly, but it's very clear that divorce is a negative thing. Thankfully, there's more on divorce in the rest of the Old Testament than there is on polygamy. But again, I'd point out the fact that every mention of polygamy in the Old Testament is a negative one. It's not forbidden outright, but it does so much damage to the family unit, to the integrity of Israel, that you can't help but see this as something that is contrary to God's institution. And that's where Christ points us, is to the institution that God has made.
So should we take Christ's words regarding divorce, and that is, for the hardness of your heart, he permitted these things, to also apply in some sense to polygamy?
Yes, I think you absolutely can. We're dealing with basically two sides of the same issue around marriage. When Paul talks about divorce, he basically says, if you marry someone who is divorced, assuming that they're the guilty party and that it's a wrongful divorce, you are committing adultery. Well, if you're committing adultery by marrying someone who's divorced, are you not also committing adultery by taking multiple wives? Both of them are departures from the one flesh union between a man and a woman that God instituted in Genesis, which is the basis upon which all marriage comes into being.
You also note that in the wisdom literature, that is Psalms and Proverbs, several other Old Testament books, including Song of Songs, we should note here, the picture of marriage is exclusively that of one man and one woman, isn't it?
It is. And that's the most intriguing thing, is when you look at Song of Songs, it talks about the great love between Solomon and the Shulamite, his beloved betrothed wife. And throughout it is a monogamous love that is going on here between the two of them that's extolled. Solomon elsewhere says that we should take pleasure in the wife of our youth, singular again. Every mention in Proverbs that speaks positively about marital relationships deals singularly with a wife, one wife, not multiple wives. And what's extraordinary about this is that we know that Solomon had 1,000 women, 700 wives and 300 concubines. Now, if anyone were to promote polygamy and say, this is a good thing, look how God has blessed me through it, you would think it would be Solomon, who's sort of the arch polygamist of the Old Testament, right? But he has nothing positive to say about it, nothing at all.
In the New Testament, you had already mentioned Christ's famous discourse on divorce. Is there anything else that we find that would answer our questions regarding the biblical text and polygamy?
Well, all of the passages that deal with marriage, especially passages like Ephesians 5, where Paul describes marriage as being an institution that is intended to depict the relationship between Christ and his church. It is a singular relationship, one bridegroom, one bride. And Paul says that all human marriages, whether they're between believers or not, are intended to reflect this divine reality of the union between Christ and the church. Now, the church, of course, is singular. It's made up of lots of people, but it's considered a corporate entity, so that it's called the body of Christ, again, singular, the bride of Christ, singular. The only time we see it plural is when we talk about the children of Christ or the brothers and sisters of Christ, which are the individual members of the church. And it kind of comes off as a mixed metaphor when we put them together. But corporately, we are one body. And so when we look at the relationship between Christ and the church, we do not see polygamy, we see monogamy. And of course, it's that relationship that causes God to give marriage in the first place, way back in Genesis. All marriage is based upon Christ and the church, one bridegroom, one bride.
That, along with Christ's words regarding the institution of marriage, seems to be kind of the foundation for the church's rejection from the very beginning of polygamy as a practice, despite its Old Testament prevalence, and the church's continued rejection of polygamy. Talk about that.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. When we understand what marriage is, all of these variances or divergences from that definition, which is made by God and enacted by Christ with the church, all of those things begin to show themselves for what they are. That when you can see what the real thing is, you now can understand what the counterfeits are, or the corruptions, if you will, are to it. And that's basically what polygamy is. It is a corruption of the good gift that God has given. It's not a rejection of the gift, but it's a corruption of the gift.
What did the early church fathers have to say on the subject, especially since polygamy hardly died out in the Greco-Roman world?
Yeah, the early church fathers are basically against polygamy, though they try to explain away the Old Testament in a couple of ways. One explanation that they give for the polygamy in the Old Testament is that it was allowed for a time and even necessary in order to fill the world with people. In other words, to enact what God had commanded in Genesis 1 and 2, that we fill the earth and subdue it. And in order to do that, they argued, and this argument is basically one out of just trying to figure out why the Old Testament has polygamy in it. They argued that polygamy was allowed in order to do that. So that's one take on the practice. Another take that we find amongst the church fathers is an idea of not so much of progressive revelation, but of progressive morality. That in that Old Testament period, people lived under a lesser moral code because these things are perfected when Christ comes and are revealed more fully. So for New Testament Christians, they said polygamy is forbidden. But in the Old Testament, you know, they weren't quite as mature as we are. They didn't have quite the knowledge or revelation that we have. And God has progressively revealed his righteousness to us, which is, of course, culminates in the revelation of Christ, who is the righteousness of God. Again, this is an attempt by some of the early church fathers to try to reconcile Old Testament polygamy and the fact that it is not condemned with this New Testament ideal of one man, one woman that's reflected in Christ and the church. The mistake they make on both counts, of course, is that they forget to listen to Christ's own way of reading the Old Testament, which points us back to the beginning. In the beginning, it was not so. So what we see there, I would argue, is not what some of the early church fathers said, but basically a rejection of what God had given. Not because they didn't know what was right, but because they wanted something else. They wanted something more. They wanted to do with God's gifts what they wanted to do rather than what God had given them for.
So finally, Pastor Kind, how would you summarize all of this? The person who says, hey, you Christians, you have no biblical basis for opposing polygamy or polyamory because in your own Old Testament, there's polygamy going on among the saints of the Old Testament, and Jesus never says one word about polygamy. How would you summarize the response?
Yeah, the response is that we look at what marriage is, and everything that the New Testament and the Old Testament teach us about the God-given institution of marriage rules out this practice of polygamy as a violation of that practice. It is not the worst violation that exists, which is probably why it's not explicitly condemned the way other violations are, such as homosexuality or incest or bestiality. But it is nonetheless a deviation away from what God has given into a realm that is forbidden.
Finally, before we let you go, would you give us a little update on the ministry there at University Lutheran Chapel in Minneapolis?
Oh, I would love to. Thanks, Todd. We are doing wonderfully by God's grace. This has been one of the most exciting years that I've had as a campus pastor. I've been pastor here for 16 years. And this year, we have two very, very exciting things happening. The first is that we have entered into a partnership with the Missouri Synod, as well as our own district, the Minnesota South District, to have a domestic missionary on our campus at the University of Minnesota. And she has been working with us, doing outreach on campus, building relationships with people, since September of 2016. And we are already beginning to see fruits from her work in the number of international students learning about Christ, asking questions, some of them even coming to adult confirmation class already and to church. It's been a huge blessing to our ministry here, and it's helped us reach out to many more students than we could before. The second thing is we are on the cusp of building our new chapel. Many of your readers or listeners are familiar with the sort of sordid tale of how we lost our chapel at the University of Minnesota. And I'm happy to say that what men meant for evil, God meant for good. And we are in a much better place than we probably ever would have been had we remained where we were. And we're praying that within the next year, we will have a brand new chapel up so that the students here at the U of M, as well as our members and others, will have a place right on campus where they can worship again. So a very exciting time for us.
That is very, very good news. Pastor David Kind is pastor of University Lutheran Chapel in Minneapolis. He's author of a chapter in the book Ethics of Sex titled Polygamy and Its Contemporary Variations in Biblical Perspective. Find out more about Ethics of Sex and this chapter at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Pastor Kind, thank you.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Folks, it's vitally important in a culture of relativism that Christians are able to make the case for natural law. And that's the title of Aaron Wolf's presentation at this summer's 2017 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Aaron will be joined by Pastor Matt Harrison, Pastor Chris Roseborough, Terry Mattingly, Pastor Peter Bender, and Pastor Todd Peppercorn. Registration is $120 and includes three meals. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org or make your $120 check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Issues Etc. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Write conference in the memo line of your check. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June the 9th and Saturday, June the 10th. In Collinsville, Illinois. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll discuss the addition of pro-life candidate to the Democratic National Committee Unity Tour with Kristen Day of Democrats for Life.
For the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach, our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.